The failure of drug war is glaringly obvious to judges, cops, wardens, prosecutors, and millions more now calling for decriminalization, legalization, the end of prohibition. Let us investigate the Century of Lies.
Hello, and welcome to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh.
My name is James Dixon. I wear a couple of hats. I'm a manager for a research project out of the University of Saskatchewan in the province of Saskatchewan in Canada, which is called the P5 Project, which I'll talk about a little bit later. I'm also finishing my doctorate in community and population health sciences, which I will be wrapping that up here in a couple of months. I'll likely to be done before the end of 2021. And I do some other research assistant work with other projects. So kind of in the research and academic world, primarily focused on substance use and the overdose crisis is where most of my energy and work is devoted.
What does P5 stand for, first of all?
Yes, P5. It stands for Perspectives, Pathways, and Priorities of People with Lived and Living Experience of Substance Use, Informing Policies. So there are five P's in there. It's a long title. It's a lot easier to say P5 than to say that whole garble. But essentially, the project is a research project in which we are wanting to talk to folks with lived living experience of substance use in Saskatoon and in Saskatchewan. And we want to hear their perspectives on issues of services such as harm reduction, treatment, recovery services in this province. We are interested in knowing their pathways, how they've navigated and maneuvered through these different services, and you know, the challenges and obstacles they faced in doing so, and their priorities, the things that they think are really important or things that they think need more attention or things that need to be done better that would suit, you know, their needs and that would come out of, you know, their lived living experience. So we're really trying to amplify the voices of lived living experience with this project. And it was born out of a first research project in which we talked to a bunch of stakeholders in Saskatoon. And these were primarily folks who were working in the field related to substance use and the overdose crisis. So doctors, physicians, nurses, pharmacists, policymakers, frontline workers, harm reduction, police. So we talked to a bunch of folks whose work was affected, but that was a small project, small pot of money. And we were very aware that, you know, there was a major gap in that work that we were doing, that we weren't actively including folks with lived living experience. We just didn't have the time or the money to do it. So this project was really born out of that, knowing that we had a gap there and that we wanted to fill the gap, but to do it in a very meaningful and appropriate way. So this project is very, it's community-based and it's patient-oriented. And I say patient-oriented in air quotes because we're in the field of health. And so in health, there's such a big push for patients of the healthcare system to have their voices and their experiences heard to better inform the healthcare system. And so we use the word patient-oriented, but we're fully aware that not everybody who uses drugs is in the healthcare system or is considered a patient, but that sentiment is still there, that it's still very much focused around that lived and living experience and that perspective and that voice is primary and crucial. So we're working with folks with lived living experience, other community stakeholders. We have a whole collaborative team that have been built specifically to do this work in this meaningful type of way, where we have advisors with lived living experience. They're embedded in our research team. We're hoping to do interviews with folks so that we can start to build a data set and build some analysis about the experiences in Saskatchewan and Saskatoon. And yeah, it's a very exciting project and we have a great team and we've been able to, you know, do some really incredible work. However, it's been very challenging to do this type of work in a pandemic, in COVID, and as I'm sure you can appreciate, connecting with and engaging with folks with lived living experience of substance use or who might have an addiction. It's a population that isn't always really easy to talk to, especially from a research perspective. You know, it's hard to get some of that buy-in sometimes. So we found that in a pandemic where we've been forced to do everything virtually, that we're having some challenges in, you know, actually moving things along. But in doing so, we've learned a lot of great lessons, and the work still speaks for itself. It's just not happening the way we initially envisioned it, which was pre-pandemic. We put together a proposal. We were excited. We got funded, and then the pandemic hit, and everything had to change. So it's been a bit of a gong show, but the nature and the intent of the work is still there, and it's still a very cool and exciting project. That was a long answer.
Well, no, fascinating. Actually, one of the other projects I'm working on has to do with health systems, and down here in the States, I'm going off script, down here in the States, the Affordable Care Act, among other things, included creation of something called the Patient-Centered Outcomes Research Initiative. The idea being that one of the problems with the U.S. health systems is that people, the patients, are not really at the center of it. The doctor's at the center of it, maybe a hospital, but the person who's receiving that medical care, the person who should be the focus of the attention is just this sort of, you know, other player off there, out there on the outside, you know, centered around the doctor, centered around the health, the hospital system. And so all these metrics, oh, this is all really good. How long do people live? Well, we have to look at other metrics than just how long people live. Yeah, well, fine. But how long are people living? You know, are they getting sick? How, bottom line kinds of things. And it's because putting people at the center of all these. And in some respects, I think it's really fascinating that you say that, because that's one of, I mean, in terms of drug control policy in general, whether it's harm reduction or decriminalization, the policies, I mean, who's at the center of these policies? Who are these really being made for? It's certainly not for the people who are using these substances, and it's not for their families. It's not for the general public. Who on earth are these policies actually supposed to be made for? So that's one of the, as an aside, I just think it's fascinating. I think that's fascinating.
No, and like you hit the nail on the head with that. That is exactly, there are parallels with this patient-centered approach. And the issues that we're seeing in drug policy, where the folks who are impacted the most, the ones who are like living and working and trying to navigate the system, their voices are either not heard at all, or they're denigrated down low, where they are given less priority than, say, a doctor or like somebody else who's on the healthcare team. So it's like you hit the nail on the head. And that was part of why I think we were successful in getting this project going, is that this patient-oriented approach just so closely aligns with so many of these conversations that have been happening for decades in the drug world and drug policy reform. So we were able to really appeal to the funders, their ideas of what they wanted to fund, this patient-centered approach. We were really able to appeal to them with this. And it was exciting. We were able to move this work forward in a way that hasn't really been moved forward in this province anyway. So you hit the nail on the head, and the timeliness of a lot of this, like the timeliness is going to be a recurring theme in this interview. There's been a lot of timing. Things aren't always happening the way that they seem, but just the context of the world around us, the overdose crisis, which we're living in, the pushing for decriminalization across the globe, really. And yeah, there have been a lot of what we've been doing has been just dictated by things that are going on around us. And so as I'll talk a little bit more about our very specific aims and goals, but the work that we've done have really expanded beyond just that to include some decriminalization work and other type of work too. But we're responding to the needs that are being asked of us, and that the demand that's out there for this type of work. And we're just doing the best that we can to address some of these needs that are identified by community, people with lived living experience, and to just offer what we can as researchers to keep this conversation moving forward. And we've been able to do that in collaboration with everyone. And that's part of why this is so exciting.
This is a conversation with James Dixon. He's a research manager for the P5 Project YXE. That's the Perspectives, Pathways, and Priorities of People with Lived and Living Experience of Substance Use at the University of Saskatchewan College of Medicine. We'll hear more in a moment. You're listening to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. Avia Hevid is a harm reduction activist and member of the Portland Drug Users Union. Now, and of course, I mean, Europe and around the world, there have been organizations, the INPUD, the International Network of People Who Use Drugs, is now a Latin American division. There are other, it is a real thing internationally. It feels like within the U.S., it's a new phenomenon. But, as you were saying, the New England, there's one that's decades old, and others around the drug use, there are groups, organizations around the country, people doing this. How much impact do you think the escalating crisis in overdose has played in that?
Yeah, like how it has had an impact on the role of like drug user activism. I think very much so, because in certain ways, I think a lot of people expect political progress to march forward steadily, but in many ways, we've seen from the DEA to just local and municipal governments, we've seen, in some areas, I live in a state that has been fortunate to pass several crucial drug policy reform measures, but those have been hard fought for by the people that are impacted by them. In many ways, progress has not been linear on these issues. We still have states that are fighting for their simple right to have needle exchanges, much less even entertaining a conversation about supervised consumption sites. And that conversation, specifically about things like supervised consumption sites and safer supply, has been kind of thrown into the spotlight, even though the U.S. politically is very not ready for that in the mainstream, because we are seeing tens and hundreds of thousands of people dying preventable deaths. And we're seeing that happen because with every normative prohibition law, the drug supply, it doesn't disappear. The demand and supply for drugs does not disappear. The complex reasons people use drugs do not disappear, but the supply itself adapts and becomes more efficient. It becomes more potent. It becomes easier to conceal and get through whatever barriers are erected around it. So, and what that results in is, for example, a concept called the Iron Law of Prohibition, where if you crack down on access to pharmaceutical opiates under the guise of trying to prevent addiction, but there are still the same complicated set of social determinants of health that are causing people to, for many various legitimate reasons, seek out opiates, what you have is more people going into the illicit heroin market. And when you have, again, laws that crack down on the illicit heroin market, you have people coming up with more potent, efficient ways to get opioids into the hand of the end user. So you get massive amounts of illicit fentanyl in the drug supply. And so with every attempt to quote unquote stop drugs in communities in the kind of ways that governments have traditionally done that and law enforcement has traditionally done that, you get a population of people that is being just basically besieged by interventions that are being advertised as what's going to save us, but they're actually killing us. And the pandemic really just sort of threw that under a spotlight, because people were even more isolated. The drug supply was even more disrupted by changes in transportation, changes in supply chain, different health and human services organizations shutting down or becoming very overwhelmed. So we had, an astronomical increase in overdoses this year alone. But that's not new. That's on the tail end of a continual exponential increase in overdoses that have resulted from just failures and compounding failures of the same ineffective policy. And so this is, not the overdose crisis of 5 years ago. This has accumulated tens of thousands of more people in this body count that is completely unnecessary. And so I think that drug user organizing has gained some allies, right? We're seeing coalitions of mothers or families who have lost people who are now starting to look at it differently. We're seeing more and more people who use drugs ourselves kind of continuing to speak up and trying to really push for uncompromising solutions in this situation. I just think now, especially issues like supervised consumption and safe supply are becoming more and more critical, that this is not something we put on the table as a theoretical conversation for 5-10 years down the line. This is something we need to fight for now. So in that way, I think that the work of drug user unions that has been happening for a long time has been put under this urgent spotlight because of this moment in the overdose crisis. And, you know, in the US, for this is, you know, for example, there have been unions that have been operating for decades, but they have been doing more underground work early on, where they were just, you know, setting up autonomous needle exchanges without permission. Nowadays, there are more states where there's organizations can surface because needle exchange is legal and say, hey, we're here. We've been doing this work. We're going to keep doing this work, and we're going to push the envelope on the next step. And now that some of those next steps are very much hot topic issues in media and in culture. So I think that the really awful events that are happening are giving us a platform to justify our existence and to speak out very loudly about these things, and that necessitate us to do that. As much as we would, you know, somewhat like to just go about our own business and take care of our own people, there's kind of like a critical time-dependent issue that, and the more time that goes by without action, is the more lives that we lose of our loved ones, and the more danger to our own lives. So I think really just the movement is. It hasn't sprung up out of nowhere, but it has been put under a spotlight by really critical conditions.
That was Avi Yoheved, a harm reduction activist and member of the Portland Drug Users Union. Find them on Twitter. They're at PDXDUU. You're listening to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. Now here's more from my conversation with James Dixon. He's a research manager for the P5 Project YXE, the Perspectives, Pathways, and Priorities of People with Lived and Living Experience of Substance Use. Okay, so now the project, you mentioned decriminalization. The P5 Project recently released a report entitled Decriminalization of Simple Drug Possession in Saskatoon, Saskatchewan, a Rapid Evidence Review. Okay, so what was the reason for their report, and what did you find?
So that's a great question. And just talking about this timeliness piece, as I'd mentioned, P5 Project is really about doing interviews with folks with lived living experience, which we are in the process of doing that right now. But part of our collaborative team, because we have a whole collaborative of folks who are working together on this, we have healthcare providers, folks with lived living experience, advisors, researchers, healthcare workers, frontline workers. So this is really It's being directed by this group. It's not just me and my boss in the ivory tower of the university deciding what is important. This has very much been a collaborative effort, and we're all working together on the same page with the same kind of goals. But one of our team members, she's an advisor for the project. She lost one of her sons to a fentanyl overdose, and her name is Marie. She's with an organization that has developed amid the overdose crisis called Moms Stop the Harm, which I'm not sure if you're familiar with Moms Stop the Harm. They're an incredible group, mothers and family members who have lost or been affected by the overdose crisis have band together to push for policy change. And they've been successful at changing some policies in Canada and just providing a really important, real, and accurate picture of what the overdose crisis is looking like, and just starting to kind of open the eyes of so many people, of Canadians who don't really understand addiction, substance use, the whole scope of it. So Marie, who is on our team, she's very involved locally in so many different, she's got her fingers in everything. Everybody wants to talk to her. She's an incredible speaker. She's a wonderful woman. And she was contacted by the mayor's office and city council to talk about the possibility of decriminalization. And she was like, yes, absolutely, I can do this, but I'm going on some holidays. So you know who else you need to talk to are some of the academics and the researchers who I'm working with and who I trust to talk to you about this. So she brought our team on board, and that's how we got into this report. Because really, yeah, like I said, P5 wasn't initially going to do decrim work, but there was just, the timing was there. There was a need for this work to be done. And there really aren't that many other folks who have access to all the evidence and who can do this type of work in this way, in a fast turnaround, and present it in an objective, I say objective in air quotes because no research is ever objective, but bringing that lens in. So she brought us in, and I wasn't part of that conversation, but my boss and Marie, they talked about what decriminalization could look like. They had conversations about, you know, the key points that were really important for the city council, like community safety, economic benefit. What does this mean for the police? What does this mean for the relationships and the people who are affected by this? So there were some kind of major points that the city wanted to know about that would help them to decide if they wanted to put together a proposal to apply to decriminalize simple possession of drugs. So we worked with them, we helped synthesize all the evidence, and we put together that little report. And essentially, I'll be the first to admit the report is pretty short, and that is because we knew this was going to government bureaucracy eyes, and governments love succinct, they love short sentences, they love to be concise, they don't have the time to listen to us ramble out for 20 pages, they don't have time to read 20 pages. So we gave them a brief snapshot, some Cole's notes, and essentially found evidence that, you know, criminalization of drug use, it doesn't actually reduce substance use or harms. If anything, it drives more harms because it pushes people to use in unsafe ways or unsafe spaces. It drives stigmatization just by the mere fact that drugs are illegal. People are pushed to using substances where, you know, where they won't be seen, where they won't get caught. Criminalization's also been very expensive. The costs associated with just simple possession charges are huge. They're astronomical. So it's actually costing so much money just for this one little simple possession of charge is just across Canada. And but that it also, decriminalization can work to reduce stigma, build community safety by connecting folks to supports, just increasing safety by the fear, by the sheer fact that folks aren't going to be maybe not as hiding their substance use as much as they would have before. There's money to be saved in justice, in healthcare systems, and that it leaves some more space to actually address target or root causes and targeted interventions to meaningfully reduce harms. Like the money that we save on, you know, justice costs can go towards better treatment systems or increased harm reduction and kind of that defunding the police model. But so the rapid evidence review, we did find that decriminalization has benefits, and the benefits, include what I said, that community safety, economic benefit, easier for the police, honestly, which we're not that I'm trying to stoke the fires between law enforcement and people who use drugs or that frontline battle. But, you know, so much cop money and time is spent and used on simple possession of drugs, which if that were taken out of the equation, think of the other things that police could use their time to do. Think of the savings that they would have from that. And just their own burnout and their own mental health and well-being. Like, police are not trained to be frontline service providers, you know, who are doing outreach and community supports and connections and things like that. So, you know, let's connect folks who need those supports in a different way, not through the law enforcement system. So, yeah, so some promising evidence that we found for sure.
So now, the Board of Police Commissioners in Saskatoon recently discussed decriminalization of drug possession. I even ran up a little bit of the audio from one of their meetings on Century of Lies not long ago. I think that I overstated the where they were in the process. There's not actually a proposal in place. What are they doing in Saskatoon?
For sure. So yeah, there's not a proposal in place yet. The city of Vancouver has submitted a proposal to decriminalize drugs through the exemption of section 56.1 of the Canadian Drugs and Substances Act. So that's That's the piece of legislation at the federal level that basically says simple possession of drugs is a criminal offense. And so Vancouver is, they have a proposal and they've put that exemption proposal through. Saskatoon, we haven't put together that proposal, but we are considering putting together that proposal. And if we do, it would be along the same vein, likely, potentially, as Vancouver in that exemption of Section 56 of the CDSA. But we're not there yet. Saskatchewan, I'm not sure how familiar you are with our province, or I'm not sure how many your listeners are familiar. You know, we're a smaller province. We're centrally located, landlocked, pretty conservative ideologically province, smaller population. Our cities, our biggest city is 250,000 people. We're pretty rural and lots of space, lots of geography, lots of farm and greenland. So we're the prairies. And so where the city of Saskatoon is at is considering submitting a proposal for decriminalization and just trying to get a feel for the evidence, consulting with different stakeholders. The city of Saskatoon and the Board of Police Commissioners, they've been having conversations with each other, with researchers, some of my team members, other folks in the community, and they're getting a grasp of what decriminalization, what a proposal might actually look like, and if it is what they want to pursue. They want to know that what they're going to put forward is going to address, you know, some of the issues that Saskatoon is facing, particularly around, you know, community safety and economic benefit, things like that. So they're considering it, and we're very lucky here in Saskatoon to have a mayor that's very open to this conversation. And same with some of our police. We have some really great police officers who act as great advocates for this. So that the conversation is even happening is really, it's exciting for Saskatchewan, especially given that we do have a typically conservative province. And I won't get into it here because I don't have the time, but there have been a lot of critiques aimed at some of the provincial responses to the overdose crisis, to just substance use, access to treatment and harm reduction. There have been some critiques leveled at the government here. It's been hard to make progress in this province, so that this is happening at the municipal and local level is an exciting time for us, for sure.
That was from my conversation with James Dixon. He's a research manager for the P5 Project YXE. That's the Perspectives, Pathways, and Priorities of People with Lived and Living Experience of Substance Use at the University of Saskatchewan College of Medicine. And for now, folks, that's it. Thank you for joining us. This has been Century of Lies. I've been your host, Doug McVeigh. Century of Lies is produced for the Drug Truth Network and distributed by the Pacifica Foundation Radio Network. Please, support your local community and public radio stations. Become a member today. You can find this edition of Century of Lies, along with an archive of past shows, at the Drug Truth Network website, drugtruth.net. There's a link there to subscribe to the Century of Lies podcast. We'll be back in a week with 30 more minutes of news and information about drug policy reform and the failed war on drugs. For now, this is Doug McVeigh saying so long. So long! For the Drug Truth Network, this is Doug McVeigh asking you to examine our policy of drug prohibition, the Century of Lies. Drug Truth Network programs archived at the James A. Baker III Institute for Public Policy.